feeling that what they do is very important to society.
It sounds like an absolutely wonderful piece. Thank you so much for telling us about it. And congrats on your first opera. I didn't realize this was the first libretto you'd written, but what a magnificent achievement.
It's so exciting. And I'm really hoping it's not the last. I had so much fun. I'm so excited to see it.
I wish that for you too. Thank you so much, Mischka.
Thank you.
That is Mischka Levine, who wrote the libretto for Information. It's set during the October crisis. It is happening Saturday and Sunday at Agora de la Danse in the Wilder Building. Tickets at levivier.ca, between $25 and $40. The show is in French and in English. How magnificent. Follow us on Upstage, CKUT, where you can get links to the companies involved with this. Thank you to Mischka, Orlando, Alec, as well as Hernan and Mathilde, all my guests this evening. Have a wonderful weekend. Up next is Grey Matters here on CKUT. We'll talk to you next week.
14448-4041, extension 2547.
Pendant plus de 30 ans, Louis-Yves Lucien, homme d'affaires, entrepreneur, s'est construit une réputation sans faille. Et son savoir-faire se définit en 5 mots. Compétence, professionnalisme, discrétion, transparence et expérience. Projet de transaction, achat, vente d'une propriété immobilière, en un tour de main, en un tour de clé, avec Louis-Yves Lucien, c'est vous qui gagnez. Qu'il s'agisse d'un premier achat ou d'acquisition d'un multi-logement locatif, investisseur immobilier, vous êtes parmi ses clients privilégiés. Il prendra plaisir à partager avec vous son savoir-faire. Contactez Louis-Yves Lucien au 514-867-8352. Ce n'est pas sans raison que la communauté se reconnaît en lui.
Good evening and welcome to the April 25th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show we have a lecture entitled Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir. It was recorded in Boulder, Colorado on March 9th of this year. The lecturer is Mohammed Younaid. Mohammed Younaid grew up in Kashmir in the 1990s. He witnessed the rise of resistance against Indian rule. He has written on Kashmir in various newspapers and magazines and is a contributor to Until My Freedom Has Come of Occupation and Resistance and Kashmiri Future. He teaches at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. So here's tonight's lecture, Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir, by Mohammed Younaid.
This combination of supremacist victim is Hindutva. And under Hindutva, any sign of, you know, Islam, Muslims, is an anathema. So holding on to Kashmir became a symbolic thing. And this is a sense shared even by many Indian liberals who believe that if India were to give freedom to Kashmir, India would fall apart. Nobody has explained to Kashmiris why that is the case. Why would giving the right to self-determination to a people would cause India to fall apart? It only shows that India is being held together by force, perhaps.
That's Mohammed Junaid, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Mohammed Junaid on Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir. India's democracy is being systematically disassembled, says renowned writer and activist Arundhati Roy. She adds, any kind of dissent is just smashed with an iron fist. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party openly espouse Hindutva, a racist ideology rooted in a mythical past and fueled by magical thinking. It's a supremacist doctrine that privileges and elevates one group, Hindus, over all others. Its animus toward Muslims is particularly acute, but Christians and other minorities also incur its wrath. Hindutva nationalists want to dominate Kashmir, India's only Muslim-majority state. The Himalayan region has endured decades of occupation by hundreds of thousands of Indian troops. There is resistance. Tens of thousands of Kashmiris are dead and missing. Human rights violations are routine. Yet, the Kashmiri quest for Azadi, freedom, continues. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, David.
India is the world's not only largest so-called democracy, but now also its most populous one. Interrogate the nature of Indian democracy, particularly when it comes to Kashmir.
Well, India is definitely the largest democracy within quotes, because it has a very large number of people living in it, many of whom do participate in elections every 5 years. But Indian democracy has become a majoritarian one. The ruling BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which has been ruling now since 2014, has turned a large chunk of the population into one massive vote bank under the name of Hindu nationalism. These people simply vote on symbolic issues, cultural issues that they believe relate to the interests of Hindus, which means that a large section of the population, minorities, they're like close to 20% Muslims. There are a large number of Dalits who are the historically marginalized undercastes have been effectively disenfranchised. BJP has made sure that these people's votes do not matter at any level, either at the constituency level or at the parliamentary level. Right now, while the percentage of Muslims, for instance, is between 18 to 20%, there is less than 3% representation they have in the parliament. And the ruling BJP has literally zero. I mean, there would be a couple of them. You could count them on the fingers, members of the parliament. And they don't field candidates in state elections who are Muslims or from any minorities. So India is a democracy in terms of having these regular elections every 5 years, but the meaning of democracy has effectively completely changed. It's no longer what it used to be.
And Kashmir is a Muslim majority area.
So Kashmir has always been a kind of state of exception within this Indian political system. Historically, the way it was annexed into the Indian Union and the way Indian political system worked or created institutions in Kashmir has always made sure that Kashmir effectively has no voice. It is an occupied territory. It's colonized. And we will soon talk about the events of August 5, 2019. But even before then, elections in Kashmir, which used to happen sometimes they would just be suspended, have often been marred by riggings, by, suppressing the opposition, by, disenfranchising large sections of the people, but sometimes coercing people to vote for the candidates that Indian government wanted to win the state assembly elections.
August 5th, 2019, the proverbial tectonic plate shift. What happens on that day? And it's interesting that in a prior conversation, you told me that the day before you had left Kashmir on August 4th to return to the United States.
Yes, August 5th, 2019 was the day that the military occupation in more formal terms became settler colonialism. A series of changes were introduced in Indian Parliament by the ruling Modi, led BJP government, and Kashmir had absolutely no say in those changes. Not only that, Kashmir was put into sort of a 7-month-long communication blockade, military siege. The entire population for 4 months couldn't go out of their homes. And I was there just before these changes took place. I left Kashmir, in fact, on morning of August 4, a day before, because there were ominous signs everywhere. Around 180,000 paramilitary soldiers were brought into Kashmir, and this is in addition to the already existing 750,000 Indian soldiers who are spread out across Kashmir. You'd go out and you'd see them, in long convoys coming, hurtling down from India. And you knew that something big was taking place. And the rumors were that there might be a war along the effective border between India and Pakistan in Kashmir. It's called the line of control. And there were other rumors that there might be a mass crackdown on Kashmiri militants. You know, these are like people who are fighting the Indian state and have taken up arms, or that there would be, all the Tehreek leaders. Tehreek is the name of this historic struggle for self-determination in Kashmir, that their leaders would be all arrested and put behind bars. The prehistory goes back to of August 5 goes back to actually when Modi came to power in 2014, and a Kashmiri party called People's Democratic Party won the elections in Kashmir, but they chose to also have, they didn't have a majority. But instead of aligning with any other party in Kashmir, they decided to align with BJP. And so the BJP and PDP formed a coalition government, which lasted for another 4 years. But in October 2018, BJP withdrew support from the government. And so Kashmir had no elected government, within quotes. And the governor rule was imposed, which was followed by a presidential rule. Then, if you recall, in February 2019, there was a bomb blast on a highway in Kashmir, and I think 40 Indian paramilitary soldiers were killed in that attack, which led to India, sending fighter bombers into Pakistani-held side of Kashmir. And then Pakistan responded, and Indian jet was downed, which led to almost like a couple of weeks of, serious tensions between India and Pakistan. Those issues got resolved a little bit, but in Kashmir, there was a big crackdown on Tehreek activists, Tehreek leaders. Many parties were banned, JKLF, Jamaat Islami, and many other Hurriyat parties. Hurriyat is like the conglomeration of many Kashmiri parties who have been historically fighting for the right to self-determination. And then it led to this event in August 5, 2019. So on the morning of August 4th, I decided to leave. I knew that if I stayed, I could get stuck for months. I mean, I've had previous experience in 2016 when India, after killing a popular Kashmiri rebel leader, imposed close to 3 months of blockade, and I had a very difficult time leaving Kashmir. And so then the next day, when I reached Delhi and I was flying out to New York, I came to realize that India had just, introduced these two legislations in the parliament. One of them was about withdrawing a historical article called Article 370, which had been negotiated between Kashmiri leaders, pro-India leaders, and Indian government in 1953 and before, and had established some sort of a semi-autonomous status for the state of Kashmir. And then the other part of this was the withdrawal of Article 35A, which was also part of the Indian Constitution, which allowed the government of Kashmir, the elected government of Kashmir, to determine residency requirements in Kashmir and who could hold land, for instance, who could buy, purchase land. The third part of this whole process on August 5th was they introduced a bill called the Jammu and Kashmir Reorganization Bill, which effectively turned the historical state of Jammu and Kashmir, which had included Ladakh region, into two union territories. There has never been a case like that after 1947 where an entity, a federal entity like a state, could be turned down into a union territory. The Indian government arbitrarily, without any reference to the people of Kashmir, Ladakh, or Jammu, decided to just reduce the status of the state into two union territories. It, for instance, meant that Kashmir would not have its legislative assembly, or even if it had ever an election again, since then we have not had any election in Kashmir, that assembly would not have any powers. Institutions like Kashmir police came under the effective control of the Union Home Minister.
Well, it fundamentally changed the governance structure.
Yes, Article 370 was negotiated, and it's important to remember that, between those leaders in Kashmir who were already pro-India, who had sort of in 1947 supported the instrument of accession. And this was a treaty signed by the Hindu Maharaja of Kashmir with the Indian government, which had given India powers over three areas, defense, communication, and foreign affairs. So Article 370 sort of formalized this relationship a bit more. In 1954, India had, which was then under Nehru, had already passed what is called a presidential order, which took away parts of that, effective parts of that article. For instance, it happened in the aftermath of Nehru arresting his friend Sheikh Abdullah, the Kashmiri leader. Over the next seven decades, India effectively took over more and more powers out of Kashmir. You know, it's just imposed, for instance, the rule of its Supreme Court, of its election commission, of many other institutions, right? So Article 370 would have prevented, if it had been carried out in its full spirit, it would have prevented Indian government from interfering in Kashmir outside of the three parameters, defense, communication, and external affairs. So by 2019, the Article 370 was effectively an empty article. Substantively, there was really nothing in it, you know. India already sort of ruled Kashmir from the center in many ways because Kashmir was under a sort of a military administration. The governor had a lot of power, and the governor in Kashmir is actually imposed by the Indian government. So the August 5th changes were a way for Modi to have this spectacle that, see, I could take away this article because he is part of an organization called the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which is a mothership of a lot of Hindu majoritarian parties. And their agenda from the very beginning, which means right after 1947, was that they could not brook Kashmir having any autonomy or any sign of autonomy. Like, you know, even after 1953, Kashmir continued to have its own flag. It had its own constitution. Its highest elected post was called the prime minister, just like in India. Even though after 1965, many of these things had been taken away by the Congress government, but the RSS, you know, in its manifestos, in its programs, would often say that we want to take even those symbolic elements away from Kashmir. What was most consequential in the changes that were made were two. One was the removal of Article 35A, because now the Indian government could allow Indians, like from mainland India, to come in and settle permanently in Kashmir. It would also remove residency requirements and giving permanent residency certificates or papers to people from India to come into Kashmir, which is what it has done ever since. And this other key component of this was giving mineral rights to Indian companies to come in and extract minerals from Kashmir. You know, one of the most consequential thing that happened right in the aftermath of Article 370's removal was giving these licenses to riverbeds, to Indian sand companies, which is a huge mafia in India. And they immediately began to bring these large excavators, caterpillar excavators to Kashmir and started digging the riverbeds, destroying really ecologically fragile land in Kashmir. So the second part that I want to talk about was the legality of the removal of the Article 370. It was very well understood by both many, by Kashmiris as well as India's constitutional experts that Article 370 was literally unremovable. It was a permanent thing, although Indian government had put it in a section called temporary measures in the constitution. But it was effectively permanent because the Article 370 could only be removed through a concurrence of what was called the Jammu and Kashmir Constituent Assembly. It's written in the 370's Clause 3 that without the concurrence of Jammu and Kashmir Constituent Assembly, the Indian government cannot remove it. But that Constituent Assembly did not exist in 2019. It had ceased to exist in 1957 after they passed the Jammu and Kashmir Constitution. And so many Kashmiris, especially the pro-India leadership of National Conference and PDP, believed that 370 was unremovable. Now, what the Indian government did was they claimed that we could read Legislative Assembly as Constituent Assembly. And so we don't need the Constituent Assembly. We could have the concurrence of the Legislative Assembly. And then they said, since there is no Legislative Assembly, well, we could read Governor of Kashmir, his concurrence as representing the Legislative Assembly. That's highly undemocratic because the governor does not represent anybody. He just is an Indian representative in Kashmir. You know, so even former judges of the Supreme Court, India's Supreme Court, many of its legal luminaries, all believed that the way Indian government carried out this process was not constitutional. It went against the spirit of the Constitution. And also the second part, you know, the turning the state into two union territories was unheard of, because in the Indian Constitution, you cannot reduce the area of a state from the center, you know, without the concurrence and recommendation of the state assembly. And you cannot turn a state into a union territory. So what India did was then to show that it was an act of sovereignty for it. Right? It could give itself exception from its own constitution. Although, you know, recently the India Supreme Court, which has had a kind of a terrible record recently, you know, in terms of claiming multiple times that what the government is doing is not right, but in the end still going ahead and supporting the government. So they now have given the judgment that the process through which this was carried out was not right, but they agreed with the government's actions, which clearly tells Kashmiris that they absolutely have no democratic future in Kashmir. They are at the mercy of the majoritarian state.
Why does Kashmir occupy such a large space in the imagination of Hindu nationalists?
It is the only Muslim-majority state in India. It becomes easy for the Hindu nationalists to whip up emotions among its constituents around Kashmir. My understanding of Hindu nationalism is that it is simultaneously a supremacist ideology and a victimized ideology. You know, they claim that they have historically been victimized by Muslims and, you know, outside, which they claim are outsiders, and they also say that they are better than everybody else, you know, that should be the ideology of the Indian state. This combination of supremacist to victim is Hindutva. And under Hindutva, any sign of, you know, Islam, Muslims, is an anathema. So Kashmir, although, you know, it has not had much role to play in the Indian subcontinent, because our historical connections were mostly with Central Asia, Iran, Tibet, and not so much with South Asia, you know, the Indian mainland or Pakistani mainland, so to speak. We kind of became trapped within this Hindu nationalist imagination. For them, somehow holding on to Kashmir became a symbolic thing. And this is a sense shared even by many Indian liberals, who believe that if India were to give freedom to Kashmir, India would fall apart. Nobody has explained to Kashmiris why that is the case. Why would giving the right to self-determination to a people would cause India to fall apart? It only shows that India is being held together by force, perhaps.
India's first prime minister was Nehru, who himself was a Kashmiri Pandit, a Kashmiri Hindu. He made multiple promises, representations in 47, 48, 49 period after partition, that the legitimate rights of representation will accrue to the Kashmiri people. In other words, they could vote on whether they wanted to be part of India, part of Pakistan, or independent.
Nehru indeed traced his lineage back to Kashmiri Pandit family. Pandits are Kashmiri Hindus. Although they had left in the middle of the 19th century, their family, and Nehru was not born in Kashmir. He had no association with Kashmir up until 1944, when it became clear that the British might leave soon. And so he wanted to secure more and more territory for India. So by 1946-47, as his visits to Kashmir became more frequent, he became much more interested in acquiring Kashmir. Kashmir at that time was, and continues to be, a Muslim-majority region, but it was under a Hindu monarchy, which was highly unpopular because, you know, it was repressive. It was, as historian Mridu Roy wrote, it was a Hindu state ruling over a Muslim subject population. So while he may have had sympathies with the Hindu state, he also wanted some kind of Kashmiri Muslim participation in the annexation of Kashmir, because this was a time that United Nations had come up. The world had just gone through this traumatic war, the Second World War. And there was like a lot of hope that we could perhaps build a better future, a world where dominant powers no longer have, you know, these expansionist ideologies. So within that spirit, you know, this is in 1947, the war between India and Pakistan broke out. This is happening in the context of the partition of the subcontinent. And Kashmir at that time was an autonomous independent entity, although it was under the overall British suzerainty, but it was not directly controlled by them. And the Hindu Maharaja himself was not clear whether he wanted to join India or Pakistan. It's likely, and there's much historical evidence to that, that he wanted to remain independent. But at that time, again, the RSS activists arrived in Kashmir. Nehru forced the Maharaja to dismiss his Prime Minister, R.C. Kak, who wanted an independent Kashmir, and to basically employ a congressman named Mahajan, who was a judge, a retired judge from Calcutta, but also an acolyte of Nehru, to be the Prime Minister. Together, the Maharaja's family, RSS, this Mahajan, they began to disarm Muslims from the Jammu region, which is the southern part, and arm the Hindus, and created this conditions for a massacre, in which we know that more than 200,000 Muslims were massacred or disappeared completely. You know, Jammu used to be, for instance, a Muslim-majority city, and by the end of the massacres in November and December, hardly any Muslims were left in the city. And during this context too, the people from Northwest Frontier Province, hearing stories of these traumas, began to arrive in Kashmir to help Kashmiri Muslims. Eventually, what it led to was a war between India and Pakistan, which ended in a stalemate because neither could win all of the territory. And Kashmiris were left helpless in this process. And that became the foundation for a format which we have sort of inherited since then. Kashmir became one of the first cases in the United Nations. The first few resolutions, for instance, that the UN passed, UN Security Council passed, were all about plebiscite in Kashmir. For instance, the Resolution 47 of United Nations Security Council, which was passed in 1948, called for a ceasefire in Kashmir, called for demilitarization in Kashmir, and plebiscite, where people of Kashmir would be asked whether they want to join India or Pakistan. And Nehru promised that this was going to happen, you know, but by 1951-52, he had given up on all of this. I mean, it's very clear that he never was sincere about it.
Arundhati Roy, in her book, The Architecture of Modern Empire, says, in Kashmir, you have a situation of what she calls terror, that any kind of dissent, I'm quoting here, that any kind of dissent, any disagreement, any sharing of the horrors that people are enduring is just smashed with an iron fist. People are in jail, journalists are threatened. Then she adds, I don't know how long you can have 6 million people living in a situation like that. So what's going on day to day in Kashmir? You have the Prime Minister in March visiting for the first time since the abrogation of Article 370, saying that Kashmir now is, quote, breathing freely. And it is a new Jammu and Kashmir that we have been waiting decades for, Prime Minister Modi said.
He clearly is concocting a reality that most Kashmiris do not live in. I think that any sane person outside Kashmir, not to mention inside Kashmir, would know that Kashmir is a highly militarized region. There's a huge army sitting on top of the population, breathing down their necks. The Indian state has put a foot on the neck of all Kashmiris. It's a state of enforced silence. Journalists, Kashmiri intellectuals, writers, artists, they're living in terror of the state. Indian government has a number of institutions, security institutions like the National Intelligence Agency, the State Intelligence Agency, the Enforcement Directorate, not to mention regular armed forces and counterinsurgency formations, and Jammu and Kashmir police, who are continuously looking at any sign of dissidence. This is not merely now speech or writing, but also possessing things like a photograph that might suggest that, you know, it's a this Kashmiri could be suspect. Yeah. So everything is under surveillance. There is digital, manual, and manual surveillance. Cameras everywhere. There is quadcopters and drones flying all around the place. This is all Modi has created, you know, and the previous regimes too. So I don't know who he is talking about when he says people are breathing free.
The destruction of the Babri Masjid in 1992 was a major event in this chronology of what's been happening to not just Kashmiri Muslims, but Muslims in India. It triggered a major massacre at the time.
Yeah, it was a turning point in Indian politics too. And it goes back to 1986 when the Indian government opened the doors of the mosque and did what is called the Shilanyas, laying the bricks foundation for the temple. This site had been under in contest since during the British era too, but it was a very regional, marginal conflict. You know, it wasn't like a national level issue. And then in 1947-48, according to the court, miscreants within courts placed that idol of Lord Rama inside the mosque, and which caused more trouble. And ever since, the Hindutva parties and RSS have turned this mosque temple issue into the national issue. I mean, if you remember, in 1992, BJP had all of 2 seats in the more than 500 seat Lok Sabha or lower house of the parliament. But by 96, they had more than 150. Because of the violence, the destruction of the mosque, and the, all the violence that it entailed all across India. In fact, that was the first time BJP came to power. It installed its first prime minister in India, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, whose government didn't last many days at that time, but they kept coming back to power. And there was a break after 2004, but it also led to further experimentation in majoritarianism, and one of the most gruesome of those was in Gujarat in 2002, when his party, which was in power at that time, turned a blind eye to ethnic cleansing of Muslims from Gujarat by Hindutva radicals. According to reports at that time, it was claimed that close to 5,000 Muslims were killed. Later, the government said it was only 3,000. Then, more recently, they've been saying it was only 1,000. But what it led to was an effective apartheid in that part of India, where Muslims were excluded from mainstream spaces. And Modi, who was the chief minister of that time, and his, you know, acolyte Amit Shah, who were part of the governance structure, rose to national prominence. Modi, up until he became the prime minister in 2014, was a persona non grata in the United States.
But once he became the prime minister, of course, those all of those things went away. Amit Shah became the home minister. And they've been carrying out these experiments. Every time there's a election, riots break out across different parts of India. Pogroms against Muslims break out. So Babri Masjid was like sort of a key element story in that.
You're listening to Mohammed Junaid on Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Critical articles about Kashmir are few and far between in the Indian media, and I should add, even in the U.S. Western media. There are threats and attacks on journalists and censorship. Even the vaunted BBC came under the wrath of the Modi regime. Their offices were raided in Delhi. Foreign journalists are denied entry, as I was in 2011, or are deported. Samrat Chaudhary, writing in Le Monde Diplomatique, says, Modi's government has muzzled India's media through arrests, tax raids, and other uses of arbitrary powers. Only a few brave independent news sources exist. So what about the media in India today vis-a-vis Kashmir?
Most of what is called the national media in India, which is privately owned, is supportive of whatever Modi is doing. And this includes both English as well as Hindi medium media. The BJP has been able to not only co-opt them, but coerce them as well. Historically, on Kashmir, media has had a consensus in India. You know, it's like, as I said, Kashmir has always been in a state of exception to the broader story in South Asia. But at least there was some level of freedom previously, where you could see occasional voices who would oppose the government. But now, if you watch India's news channels, you'd feel like they are like the public relations officers of the regime. They also claim that India is entering what Modi has called the Amrit Kal, this great era of Indian civilization that is now going to last 1,000 years of Hindu dominance, and where the influence of the Mughals and the British and everybody has been wiped clean. The media has become an echo chamber. Everybody is falling over each other to be seen as more loyal to Modi than the other one. Within this climate, you know, it's very hard for people. Kashmir was already hard, but even in India, to report objectively, to report even human interest stories that might appear critical of the Modi regime. You know, I mean, foreign journalists find it difficult to agree with what Modi is saying unless they are like part of some, you know, business newspapers who like would like to do business in India. And, I mean, more recently, I've seen a series of people, not only people who are like foreigners, but people of Indian origin have what is called the OCI, Overseas Citizen of India, which allows them to travel. It's a lifetime thing that it allows them to come to India, to live there, to have a job. But they have been deported. A series of them have been deported from India. So yeah, we're getting into a much more repressive state than ever before. And clearly, there seems to be no end to it at this stage.
And the government, Modi's regime, has run a sustained PR campaign about itself and all the wonders of globalization and economic capitalism. But those who resist Delhi's rule are called terrorists and agents of neighboring Pakistan. In terms of international law, though, people under occupation have the right to resist.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, but Indian government does not care about international law or international norms anymore. Previously, it was Kashmiris who were called Pakistani-sponsored. Now, even Congress people who used to call Kashmiris Pakistani-sponsored, they are even told that they should go to Pakistan if they are critical of Modi. So it seems that
for Hindutva, Pakistan has like too much power over India, which obviously is completely untrue. It's easy for a regime like Modi to claim everybody is supported by Pakistan who does not agree with him.
I want you to talk about two terms, Atut Ang and Azadi.
Atut Ang is the term that Kashmir is an inalienable part of India. It is this organic imagination of India as Bharat Mata, the mother goddess India, and who Hindu nationalists and other nationalists in India have always claimed that Kashmir is the crown that, well, Kashmiris have never had that imagination. Kashmir historically was never part of India. There was no India in, for that matter, you know, as it exists now. South Asia had always been this layered geography of sovereignties. Sometimes empires would emerge, then they would disappear. And Kashmir has a much longer history of being an independent entity than being under any imperial control. So for Kashmiris, Azadi means freedom. It also means freedom not only in the political sense of like having sovereignty, having control of its own affairs, but also means freedom from hierarchy, freedom from India's underlying caste system, because India has, you know, caste is a big issue in India. It's a structuring element of the state. Hindutva is the ideology of the upper castes. And for them, to maintain the caste order, they need to maintain the Indian state as an empire. For Kashmiris, to get out of that caste order means to get rid of the Indian state's control over their lives. So those are interlinked projects. Azadi is freedom in a sovereign political sense, but also in a progressive sense, freedom from this hierarchical arrangement that has been imposed on them.
The Hindutva crowd was telling Indian Muslims, you know, it's Pakistan ya Kabristan. You have a choice. You can go to Pakistan or you can wind up in the cemetery dead.
Yeah, and this is a slogan since 1947 and 46, actually. Indian Muslims, many of them perhaps, you know, either could not leave for Pakistan in 1947 because they were geographically dispersed, or they would have to give up so much of their belongings and destroy their kinship relations to be in Pakistan. And many made a voluntary choice to stay in India. They did believe at that time that India could become a secular place where they would be respected, or they would have equal citizenship. That even though there might be tensions, occasionally intercommunal tensions, but the state would be neutral enough to be an honest broker and a protector of the minorities. Of course, those have fallen flat. Those ideas have not turned out to be true. India can under no imagination be seen as a secular state anymore. You know, it has turned into a majoritarian ethnocracy. And in the BJP regime has erased Muslims from India's history, you know, Muslim influence from Indian history. They have disenfranchised them. When I say minority, you know, Muslims are minority, this in actual numbers, this is close to 200 million people. That's like more than half of United States population that has been effectively disenfranchised.
What's your sense, if there were a plebiscite today, how would that vote go? Do you think Kashmiris would opt for unification with Pakistan or some kind of independence, autonomy within the Indian Union?
If there was an option of independence, I think that most Kashmiris would vote for that. But in the absence of an option for independence, they would vote for some kind of an arrangement with Pakistan.
Talk about India's growing alliance with Israel. Aparna Gopalan, in these times, in an article entitled Israel, India, and the Ethno-Nationalist Right, she writes, India has used Israeli drones, rifles, surveillance systems, fighter jets, bombs, and cybersecurity in its occupation of Kashmir. but has trained its security forces in Israel and borrowed Israeli tactics such as, in quotes, surgical strike raids. What about that growing relationship? And you've reported on a very unusual comment from the Indian Consul General in New York.
When I returned to the U.S., and some diaspora Kashmiris were very concerned about their relatives back home, and so they were organizing, trying to ask the U.S. government to tell the, you know, Indian government to reopen the internet in Kashmir. We came across a clip which somebody has shared that the Indian Consul General in New York was meeting some Hindu activists in the U.S. and telling them, we're going to do to Kashmiris what Israel is doing to Palestine, which is precisely what August 5 was about, the initiation of the settler colonialism. Modi and Netanyahu are quite buddies. They share a close relationship. And there is also a lot of affinity between Hindutva groups and Zionists. You know, after this Israeli assaults in Gaza, some of the biggest supporters of Israel are Indian trolls on social media. And there are many Indians who have expressed an interest in going to fight on Israel's behalf. But Hindutva activists have often argued that what Israel is doing to Gazans and Palestinians in general is what India should be doing to Kashmiris and Muslims in general across India. Now, the relationship is ideological. I mean, there's a mutual ideology of hatred that they share towards Muslims. That's one element of it. The second is that both Zionism and Hindutva share a similar sort of supremacist victim ideology, where they simultaneously claim to be supremacist. You know, they want to impose their vision on their occupied people or their subject populations, while they also draw the inspiration for this from the history of victimization. For Zionists, that is the whatever happened to them in Europe, from pogroms to Holocaust. For Hindutva, it's harder to find that in history. So they have to invent figures like the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb and other Muslim rulers of medieval India to and claim that they had done terrible things to the Hindus. Like Babri Masjid, for instance, is a classic example of this narrative where they believe that Babur, one of the first Mughal emperor, had tasked one of his generals to destroy a pre-existing temple to build a mosque there. Well, but of course, history doesn't bear this. Archaeological survey of India, despite their best efforts, could never find any evidence. And they did find a temple somewhere close by, but that had been either destroyed by natural ravages. And there was no evidence that Lord Rama was either an actual historical figure or born there.
A constant argument the Indian state uses against the perfidious, in their view, Kashmiris, is the treatment of Kashmiri Hindus, pundits, in the early 1990s. What about that?
Kashmiri pundits have gone through a lot. Many of them left in the early years of this mass upsurge against the Indian state. Of course, the movement was not directed against the Kashmiri Hindus. Kashmir has 95% Muslims and 3-4%, historically speaking, Kashmiri pundits. Most of these were Brahmins. And so Hindus and Muslims in Kashmir have historically been closely entwined. They share the same language, many of similar traditions, culture. But there was a fear among Kashmiri pundits about what would this upsurge against the Indian state mean. Because many of the Kashmiri pundits believed that they needed the Indian state to protect them. You know, Pakistan took over Kashmir. In 1990, January to be precise, when Kashmiri pundits left, and now many of them claim that they left out of fear, Kashmiri Muslims would argue, for instance, that it was the governor of that time, Jagmohan, who told pundits to leave, and he was going to roll the tanks on Muslims, and they could come back at the end of the winter. But that end never came, you know, because more people this guy killed, more the insurgency kind of expanded, and now we're like 32 years later. And although a small number of Kashmiri Hindus have continued to remain, I think around 7,000 families, and they have lived throughout there, and even Tehreek leaders have often asked Kashmiri pundits to return to their homes. But as some of my Kashmiri pundit, you know, scholar colleagues have said, Kashmiri pundit suffering has been weaponized by the Indian state, especially by Hindutva, against both Muslims in India and as well as Kashmiris in general.
Suvir Kaul, a Kashmiri pundit who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, in his book Of Gardens and Graves writes, "The future, certainly the possibility of a political resolution of the problem of Kashmir, he says, looks bleak. India grows increasingly powerful economically and militarily, and its aspirations towards regional superpower status means that its strategic planners will deny any possibility of self-determination for Kashmiris." What do you think of Kaul's analysis?
I think that, you know, Kashmiris cannot afford to be hopeless, because it's a struggle for survival. I mean, what else can we do but continue to, like, seek our freedom? The other option would be to just die, which is what Indian state would probably want. I mean, I don't agree with these bleak worldviews.
Washington has been looking the other way while Modi fuels rampant Islamophobia and human rights abuses. It's silent about Kashmir. Why?
India has been now projected as this frontline state against China. Although India was expected to do more than that on, for instance, Russia-Ukraine question, India has continued to defy Washington. It's become one of the biggest purchasers of Russian oil. In terms of China, U.S. hopes that if they can arm India, if they can, like, prep India to be the frontline state, they don't have to do the fighting themselves. And secondly, India has a middle class now. It's a very small percentage of the population, but in sheer numbers, it's a large section of the people. They travel globally and they consume products. For these reasons, U.S. has been mostly silent on what is going on in India.
State oppression in Kashmir and elsewhere in India, I may add, is cloaked in such laws as the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, known by the acronym AFSPA, and the Public Safety Act. Talk about these so-called legal mechanisms of control.
Both of these, AFSPA and PSA, are colonial-era laws. When I mean colonial, I mean British colonial-era laws. They were imposed in frontier regions where the British believed that they did not have, they could not have indirect control. They needed much more authority for their armed forces to act with impunity. Public Safety Act has its roots in apartheid South Africa. It allowed for, you know, preventative detention of activists, thinkers, writers, and who had then no recourse to any legal measures. And these tactics, India has continued, and these remain on the books. Kashmir is officially considered to be a disturbed area in the Indian, you know, legal lexicon. But what it means is that while the Indian military has committed huge human rights abuses over the last few decades, there have been very few, if any, you know, proceedings against the Indian armed officers or soldiers for those violations.
You teach here in the United States. People here know very little about Kashmir. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that one of the things that I have realized is that we cannot afford America, which has such a huge global influence and plays a big, overwhelming role in maintaining the order that there exists, the imperial order, that we cannot afford American public to be ignorant about these issues, because they do play a big role. And I'm hopeful. I mean, I'm seeing these young people coming out to protest against the Israeli actions in Gaza, against what they are doing. It's quite heartening to see that the newer generation is becoming more aware of the destructive policies of these rogue actors around the world and how the U.S. government keeps supporting them. We need to keep educating people about what is happening in Kashmir, because what is happening in Kashmir, what's happening in Palestine, what's happening in Nagorno or Kurdistan, what's happening all around the world to indigenous peoples is part of the same chain of colonialism that has never ended.
In Kashmiri Futures, you and your co-authors Deepti Misri and Atharazia write, I'm quoting, "Kashmir is in a moment when imagining alternative futures looks difficult, even absurd. Yet it is precisely at this moment that continuing to imagine such futures becomes a radical act."
Absolutely. I think, as I said, we cannot afford to not continue to resist, because if we did stop, it will mean we stop existing. So imagining the futures, imagining possibilities, imagining alternative ways of belonging and being in the world is a radical act, because, you know, we are being told that accept this as the reality now, the reality of power, the dominance and hegemony and imperialism are the future in which we are going to live. Either you are, you know, the Bush's logic, or either you are with us or with against us. I think, you know, people in Kashmir and elsewhere don't want to be with us or against us. They just want to be something else. They don't want to be determined by these colonial relations.
You know, given what we've talked about, the hundreds of thousands of Indian troops in Kashmir, the abrogation of Article 370, all of these negative impacts on Kashmiri people, what in the end gives you hope that things will change for the better?
Kashmir's history is a long one. We have had several periods throughout that history where foreign occupiers, you know, autocrats, killers, mercenaries have come and tried to dominate the place. But at the end, the Kashmiris have sort of survived. All of that experience have left traumas and pain behind, but Kashmiris have survived. That tradition is strong enough. We also believe now that we live in a much more interconnected world where the forces of oppression are also tied together, right? I mean, they share logistics and information about how to dominate subject populations, but so are the people who are resisting. You know, they're learning about each other's struggles, and I think that gives me hope too.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, David.
You were just listening to Mohammed Junaid on Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir. I talked with him in Boulder, Colorado. Mohammed Junaid has written on Kashmir in various journals and magazines. He teaches at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Sarah Scholes, Eugene Perrier, Ralph Nader, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. And we have a series of programs on Kashmir. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Mohammed Junaid on Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir, and for Arundhati Roy's new book, The Architecture of Modern Empire, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. 1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
So that concludes this week's edition of Gray Matters. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation from Alternative Radio down in Boulder, Colorado. You were listening to Mohamed Younaid and the lecture entitled Modi, Hindutva, and Kashmir. Check out more lectures at Alternative Radio's website, www.alternativeradio.org.
Help us spread the word. CKUT is looking for someone to join our team as the chair of the board of directors. Our board of directors reads the fine print, approves the annual budget, engages in community outreach, and keeps CKUT's eye on the bigger picture. The board meets for 2 hours every month, and the chair circulates agendas, keeps meetings organized, and acts as a liaison between the outside world and the board. If you're passionate about the station, this is an opportunity to help lead CKUT into a new era of community media. For more information, please send a message to admin@ckut.ca.
Production Nuit d'Afrique invites you to the gala of the 17th edition of Sli d'Or de la Musique du Monde. See you on Tuesday, April 25th at La Tulipe from 8 p.m. onwards. Come out and support your favorite artists to help them win the Sli d'Or d'Argent and des Bronzes. The Sli d'Or de la Musique du Monde is a celebration that brings the cultures of the world together. For more information, visit slidor.com. Quebec-raised singer Andrea Superstein is one of the most versatile voices in music today. The new album, Oh Mother, is an ambitious tour de force, highlighting her ever-growing creativity and sensitivity as a songwriter and arranger. Oh Mother is available now. Andrea will be performing at Upstairs Jazz Club in Montreal on Friday, May 3rd. For more information about the show,